Good afternoon and welcome to our fourth town hall meeting. I hope you have been able to join us for our other forums on education, affordable sustainable growth, and jobs and a living wage. But if you have not, you can go to our website, www.michaeldbrown2014.com, and access them there. I am looking forward to today's forum on statehood and honest government, subject we all definitely need to talk about. We will hold one last open forum next week at 2 p.m. on Sunday, October the 19th. And I hope that you will join us then with all your questions for our candidate for D.C. City Council at Large, Michael D. Brown. I am your moderator, Kathleen Gomez, and I'm here to facilitate the conversation, propose questions to the candidate, and make sure these meetings provide the kind of information you need to make an informed choice in the upcoming November election for D.C. City Council at Large. These town hall meetings are designed to give you, the voter, the opportunity to call in and have your concerns addressed by the candidate, your questions answered, and your voice heard on the issues that are most important to you and to our city. We hope you will join in the discussion by calling in at 888-429-5471, or you can Skype your questions to BBS Radio 2. Esperamos que se unan en la discusión llamando al 888-429-5471. Y no puedes Skype sus preguntas a bbsradio.com2. Each town hall meeting will be conducted on this internet platform for an hour on Sundays at 2 p.m. They will each deal with a different topic, and as I said, the final one will be next Sunday, October 19th, and will be an open forum. So you can call in with anything that that is of interest to you or is an important issue that you think should be looked at. Today's discussion, we will focus on statehood and honest government. I would like to point out, however, that you are always free to ask a question on whatever issue is most important to you. I will take as many questions as possible, and I reserve the right to limit the time to ask or answer any one question. Let me point out that any question that remains unanswered at the end of the meeting can be submitted to Mr. Brown's website at www.michaeldbrown2014.com. Now, let me introduce the candidate, Michael D. Brown, for an opening statement. Good afternoon, Mr. Brown. Welcome, and I look forward to an interesting and lively discussion as always.
Thanks, Kathleen. I really appreciate it. And I think, you know, our campaign has done many innovative things, but I think this is one of the most innovative, single most innovative ideas is to get input from the people who actually vote out there. And, you know, we have 15 candidates in this race. So when we've gone to public forums, we get a question or two, and I don't think people get to really hear what I have to say as a candidate or get to ask their questions and let us know how they feel. So thanks very much for helping me do this. I think it's very important. Today we're going to start with statehood, and I'd like to make that my opening statement. Every year, according to the public interest group DC Appleseed, the residents of the District of Columbia lose between $2 and $3 billion by not being a state with the ability that all states have to tax income at its source. 70% of the people who work in the District of Columbia live outside the city, leaving the rest of us to support the local operation of the nation's capital. In addition, there is a structural imbalance due to the fact that we cannot tax any of the federal buildings or many of the colleges and universities that call DC home. We also must absorb much of the expense of hosting the federal government. This, of course, is in addition to the fact that we're the only democracy in the world that denies our residents the right to equal citizenship. We pay the highest per capita federal taxes in America. More than 200,000 of us have served in combat, 2,000 of whom have been wounded or killed in defense of our liberty, and still we have no real voice in our national legislature. Additionally, we do not have ultimate control over our local budget or our legal system. These factors affect everything in our city. We fulfill all the obligations to citizenship. We are still treated like second-class citizens. Our laws are periodically threatened, and our budget is manipulated annually by Congress. Attempts to get a single vote in the House of Representatives, to amend the Constitution, and most recently to pass a referendum on budget autonomy have all failed. The only path to true equality for residents of the District of Columbia is statehood. Only by entering the Union on equal footing as the 51st state can we become equal American citizens. Not only is statehood the most direct path to equality for the residents of the district, it is the least complicated. It takes a simple majority vote of both houses in Congress and a signature from the president. I recently testified before the United States Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs in support of the New Columbia Admission Act. Hundreds of D.C. residents came to show their support for this movement, and our movement is growing. Currently, there is legislation before the City Council to fund the statehood movement, which has not moved in over a year. It's time for the Council to stand up for the citizens of the District of Columbia and move forward on this funding. President Obama has told me personally in a meeting at American University that he would sign a statehood bill into law. In July, he said publicly, "I'm for it." Puerto Rico invests $20 million a year in their effort to become a state, and in the district, we leave it up to a delegation of volunteers that is not properly funded. It's time, D.C., to get someone on the City Council who will focus on getting our equal rights and collecting our money. It's time for statehood.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Brown. You're very knowledgeable, of course, on the subject since you've been doing it for so long. If you had your, druthers, as they would say, what would you want to happen in the next couple months? What would you be focusing on as far as pushing statehood through?
Well, in the short term, we need to do a couple of things. We now have 109 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives and 20 co-sponsors in the Senate. This is more than we've ever had on our statehood bill. But what we need to do is to continue on that effort to get co-signers, and we need to fund the delegation that I'm a part of, the statehood delegation, so that we can spread the word through America that we're disenfranchised. We can't bestow statehood upon ourselves. We need the help of people outside the District of Columbia to put pressure on their representatives and senators to help us get co-sponsors for our bill and to get this legislation passed. And that's going to take some money. It's going to take some commitment. It's going to take an effort. And so far, we've seen very little forthcoming from our city council, and that's terrible. They're passing a bill right now. They had the first reading the other day, which would just give us a handful of money, just a mere pittance of what we need to accomplish this, and then they want to be in control of it, and that's just ridiculous. We're elected officials. We should have control of our own budget, and that's one of the main reasons I'm running for city council, to get somebody on there that cares about making the citizens of the District of Columbia equal. It's been 213 years.
And let me ask you something. Can they alter? Even though you are not a state, they elect you to a senatorial position, correct?
Yes.
Just as if you were a state, you go through it just like somebody like Harry Reid does, or Ron Barber, or John McCain. You do the same process. So if they pass legislation where they're somewhat in the process, aren't they then changing the way the Senate position the senator would operate and would be able to operate?
Well, you know, in theory, you're right. And I think that's one of the things that we have to decide. And as citizens, we should stand up and push them on this, because the position was created by a constitutional convention. And at that time, we were supposed to be given a budget of over $1 million. And that was in the early 1980s. So today that would be several million dollars. We're supposed to be paid a salary like other senators and congressmen, or representatives rather, and they've never followed through on that. But the reality of it is that the city council controls our city, the city council and the mayor. So they rewrote the law the way they wanted it, and now they're trying to consolidate it and make it a little more efficient, but it's still woefully inadequate, and it still leaves control in their hands. I guess they have a legal right to do that, but I think it's time that the citizens of the District of Columbia stand up and say, you don't have a moral right to do that. I think you're right. I think that we are elected to be senators, and we should be allowed to be senators as much as we can with inside the district, and I don't think that they should inhibit that. You know, I go to every ward in this city all the time. Today I was in Ward 8. Yesterday, I was in Ward 1. The day before, I was in Ward 2. And we're campaigning, and I hear the same thing from every person and that comes up to me in one form or another, whether they're talking about zoning or development. No matter what they're talking about, they come to me and they say, we have a city council that doesn't listen to us, a city council that's not responsive. And I think when it comes to the issue of statehood, this is the classic example of this. They're just not listening to what the people want. The President of the United States said, I'm for it. Harry Reid said, I think the people of the district deserve this. We've got both Maryland senators as co-sponsors of our bill. Leadership in both houses are standing behind us. Now is the time to move, and our city council is turning a deaf ear towards this, and we need to change that.
Excuse me. Yes, I agree with you. Here's a question that Skyped in by, excuse me, Desiree. What is the difference on budget autonomy versus statehood?
Well, budget autonomy is just what it says. It gives us autonomy over our budget. It allows us to spend our own money without the approval of Congress. But that's all. It's really at best, it's an interim step. And at worst, it's an interference with our ultimate goal of getting statehood. And I think that's what some people worry about, myself included, that if you get a few things like budget autonomy, the people up on the Hill will say, well, you know, you've gotten this little bit and it helps you. And why do you want more? I think we have the same problem with the budgeting process in the council right now, which is attempting to give us a little bit of money. But statehood gives us everything. It's when you enter the United States as a state, you enter on equal footing, which means that you get everything that every other state has. So you have budget autonomy, legal autonomy, representation in the Senate, representation in the House of Representatives, control over your own affairs like every other state. And budget autonomy gives you nothing but budget autonomy, autonomy over your budget, which means your ability to spend your own local tax money. Now, we passed a referendum to have budget autonomy in 2012, but unfortunately, Congress has advised us that it violates the Home Rule Charter. The mayor and the attorney general in the District of Columbia agree with that advisement, that opinion.
Really?
That came out of the Congressional Research Service. So we're not moving ahead with budget autonomy. So even though we voted in the democratic process, our election, to have autonomy over our budget, it's not going to happen. And you know what we need to do is we need to become a state to make it all happen. We shouldn't get a piece of a small piece of the pie, or a lot of people like to say crumbs from the table. We ought to stand up and have it all. We're equal citizens. You know, for me, budget autonomy is like Rosa Parks saying, okay, let me sit in the middle of the bus. No, you pay the same fare. You get to ride just like everybody else. And if you want to ride like everybody else, that ride is statehood.
Well, let me ask you this. A lot of laws are being passed. You know that the Attorney General was for putting forth, I guess it was like you guys have been legalizing, decriminalizing possession of marijuana. Now there's a referendum, 71, on the ballot that is basically legalizing marijuana in D.C. Now, how, if the court says that you violate the Home Rule Charter by budget autonomy, how can you be in charge of your laws? Because wouldn't this be the same thing they would say? And aren't they trying to stop you from some of the laws that you've passed, whether it be gun control or you know, legalizing marijuana?
Well, we have that problem all the time. I mean, certainly our gun control laws at issue right now. We're working on carry permits because the court said that our gun laws were too restrictive. And most people don't realize this, but we have a conservative court in the District of Columbia that decides on such issues at the federal level because we don't have senators to some extent. That's responsible for a conservative court. Imagine we're the most liberal, in many respects, the most liberal jurisdiction in America, but we have two conservative judges, and that's because generally senators are involved in the approval process, but that's not going on in the District of Columbia. We don't get to approve federal judges because we don't have senators. Right now, we have a judge whose approval in the Senate has been pending for 18 months, and there's a vacancy on the bench, and there's more vacancies coming on the bench. And this is a judge, a well-qualified man named Nutter, who has been approved, but has been accepted by the Senate, but has yet to be approved because Congress is gridlocked, and we suffer for that because there's a vacancy on the bench. There also is fear that, much like the budget autonomy referendum, when the marijuana referendum, if it should pass, and they've done recent pollings to show that 61% of the people are in favor of this Proposition 71, but there's a fear that if it passes, it won't be ever enacted because the Congress of the United States will prohibit it. You know, in Congress, under Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, it says that Congress shall have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, which basically means that Congress can do whatever it wants with the District of Columbia. So there's a lot of fear that we'll put this to a vote. They've spent lots of money and lots of time. I think they got 60,000 signatures, something like that, 30, 60,000 to get it on the ballot. We're going to vote on it on November 4th. But in the end, what Congress decides will be the ultimately what happens to it. So we might decide to do this and have it overturned. It happens all the time. And it really is a complex interaction between the courts and Congress, the federal courts and Congress. And the only way to resolve that is to become a state. Then we have control over our own destiny.
All right. We have another question that's been Skyped in by Paul. And he says, why do you do it for free?
Why do I work for free?
I guess, why do you work for free? Yes.
Yeah, because you got to. Somebody has to do this. I mean, this is, to me, it just seems crazy that we even debate this issue, because this is the issue that formed this country, right? Our license plates say taxation without representation. That was the idea behind the founding of America, and we sit around and debate this. Is it the right thing? Is it the wrong thing? Well, of course it's the right thing. And so it's really been an honor for me to represent the people of the District of Columbia and fight this battle for them. And I will say with great pride that when I took this job, we talked about getting a vote for our representative on the Hill, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and that would have given us one vote, no budget autonomy, no legal autonomy, no representation in the Senate. But today we talk about statehood. And we talk about statehood because I've worked hard at this. Others have worked hard at this. We have a group of activists who have worked hard at this. Eleanor Holmes Norton herself has worked hard at this. We've all worked hard to bring this to this point. And now, the reason that I don't, in case this is what Paul really wants to know, why I don't continue in this position, right now, I think we need to get somebody on the council because they're the ones with the clout to push this issue. There are many issues that the council has to deal with, but this is one of the most important issues, and they really don't pay much attention to this issue. So I've done it for free because it's the right thing to do. But it's time for me to move on so that we can push this at a higher level and finally make it happen. We have the momentum here to make it happen. We're just not doing anything. So I hope that answers your question, Paul.
Yeah, that is a good answer. Now we have Alice on line one. Alice, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, well, thank you, Alice. Do you have a question for Mr. Brown?
Yes, I would like to know why he's so interested in statehood and why not just allow the district to retrocede back to Maryland.
Well, that's a good question, Alice. And actually, retroceding back to Maryland would solve our problems because retrocession is really statehood by a different name. You become part of a state. And there are many countries in the world who have resolved the situation that we're in, not really by retrocession, but by creating that situation to begin with, where the capital is part of the larger state that surrounds it. And if we had done that originally, that would have worked fine. We had, when the city was set up, part of it was given to us by Maryland, as you probably know, and part of it was given to us by Virginia. We have returned the Virginia portion to Virginia because in the early 1800, 1847, I believe, we returned it because there were slave owners, plantation owners in Virginia that were afraid that the district would end slavery and that would be a hardship for them. And in fact, the district was the first place in America to end slavery. We're very proud of it. We celebrate it every April 16th. It's the only holiday we have in the District of Columbia, Emancipation Day. It was the one compensated emancipation in America. And we're very proud that Washington was the first place in the United States to end slavery. But that set the precedent for giving Virginia back, you know, and it set the precedent for retrocession. So a lot of people bring this up. But here's the problem. 200 years have passed. Each jurisdiction, Maryland and Washington, have developed their own character. In addition to that, retrocession could only happen if Maryland agreed to it. We've queried them on this, and they've said no, they're not interested. And there's a lot of political problems, probably explain why they're not interested. First of all, Washington is solidly Democratic. We're the single most Democratic jurisdiction in America. So the Republicans in Maryland would not be anxious to get back 500,000 registered Democrats. That would upset the political balance in Maryland, which tends to be more equally divided between Democrats and Republicans. Another problem is that Baltimore is the only urban center in Maryland, And Washington and Baltimore are approximately the same size. So if you bring Washington into Maryland, you double the urban population of Maryland. And people that don't live in urban areas like the Eastern Shore would object to that politically. So there are a lot of political problems in returning Washington to Maryland. And it's a very complicated process. And the simpler process is statehood, and statehood gives us everything. It allows us to keep our character, the way we became a state, the way we would become a state is exactly how Ohio became a state. We just had a conservative in front of the Senate who testified with me, a man named Viet Dinh, who was part of Bush's Justice Department, make that exact point, that Ohio became a state the same way we're trying to become a state, carved out of another state. They didn't retrocede. They stood on their own for the same reasons we're trying to stand on our own. They had their own character. They had their own political system. They had developed along separate lines. So that's why we don't do it. One, because it would be very, very difficult to accomplish. And two, I don't think that either party would be satisfied with it, either Maryland or D.C. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling in. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay, thanks.
Here's a question from Zoe. What do you think of Eric Holder heading a presidential commission on statehood?
Well, there's been a lot of controversy about that. I've heard statehood advocates say, that's ridiculous. We don't need a presidential commission to see whether this is the right thing to do or not. We know it's the right thing to do. And, of course, this whole Eric Holder thing, I guess what she's referring to, is something that the Washington Post suggested in an editorial a few weeks ago. I think it would be a good thing. Because I think, personally, our biggest problem is, or one of our biggest problems, is that people outside the District of Columbia don't understand the situation we're in. And a presidential commission could illuminate that for people and educate people on that. And Eric Holder, you know, being a big name and having an important position as our attorney general, former attorney general now, could bring a lot of substance to the argument, I think, and credence to it, and spread the word. And I think that's important. We can't bestow statehood on ourselves. If we could, we would have done it already. So we need the help of people outside the district, and I think it would be a big help if he'd be willing to do it. I think it's I think once people find out about the situation, they want to help us change it because it is so basic to our democracy.
Now, this is just my personal opinion, not an opinion of anything other than myself. And being outside of the district, you know, coming from Arizona and being a great thing outside the Beltway, you know, a lot of people don't like Eric Holder. And I'm just wondering, in taking the devil's advocate here, that they will, it may not get you the support that you're looking, just because from the people I know that I speak to throughout the Southwest and even the Midwest, you know, they're unfortunately, Mr. Holder has got kind of a bad rep. I mean, do you see that sometimes maybe it's just what's important is that the people fight for what they need instead of looking for, like, say, celebrities or, you know, high government officials to step in to lead them? Shouldn't it just be the people doing it for themselves?
Well, I think you're probably making the argument that some of the activists would make. I don't agree with that, but I think that's the argument they would make. Look, this is a matter of basic democracy, so I don't think it's a matter of personality. You know, I think that Americans, there are certain values, core values in America that we all ascribe to, and certainly one of them is equality. And I think when it comes to this, people would personality aside, I think they would rise above it. For example, you know, if you look at another presidential commission, if you look at the Warren Commission, that, for example, that looked into the assassination of President Kennedy, do we really care who was in charge of that commission? Do we really care that it was Earl Warren, who was the Chief Justice? I mean, could it have been somebody else? And we would have still wanted the commission, you know, convened and would have wanted to know what happened. We never really did find out from the Warren Commission, did we?
But no, and the point is, there's questions about it too.
Questions about it. And, you know, they sealed the results for 50 years, I think, because of the things they found out. But we digress here. I think the point is that if we had a commission, people would look at the substance rather than personality. I hope they would anyway, because, you know, I go all over the country talking about this, about statehood, and people respond very positively. They go, of course you should be equal. Of course you should have the same rights that everybody else has. It's just ridiculous that you don't have the same rights. And it's funny that locally we can't seem to get the politicians to do anything but talk about it, because there's a lot of support for it nationwide. And I think if we get out there, we'll not only find that, but that will help the cause a lot. And I think that, Eleanor Holmes Norton said something very important in a meeting that I had with her not long ago. She said, nothing ever gets generated inside the walls of Congress. Everything comes from the outside. So I think that we really need to get this out there and get talking about it, so that we get people interested in understanding what's going on and involved in discussion. And the more we get this discussion out there, I think the more we'll move it. That's why we need the city council to stand up behind it, provide funding for it, and move it, because we really need to get the word out and get the ball rolling. The president is for it, the leadership in both houses are for it. Now we need our city council and the people of Washington, D.C. to be for it. I think Eric Holder helps all the way around on all those issues.
Okay. Well, I guess we should move on to corruption and the issue of honest government. And heaven knows there's been lots of stories and lots of drama and lots of, you know, people going to jail on just that, corruption and having an honest government. Can you tell us, just like, I mean, I'm new to the area, but I think a lot of people would like to know, like, what is the update now as far as who's going to jail in the past year or so? I mean, there was a lot of drama on this whole issue, wasn't there?
Yeah. Unfortunately, we only have an hour, so I'm not sure that I can tell you everybody that's going to jail. And it's sad, you know, it really is sad. We make light of it, and I make light of it too, but it's just terrible in Washington. You have five of the top people in the mayor's 2010 campaign. Now, you know, let's just go over that slowly. Five people in the last mayoral campaign. This isn't ancient history. This is just the last mayoral campaign. Five of the top people have pled guilty to various felonies. In addition to that, you have the mayor himself, who's been under investigation for 4 years. Of course, he's never been charged with anything. And I don't know what's worse, that he's been under investigation or that he's never been charged, because he's not even in this race. He lost the primary because of a felon who came out and said that he was a co-conspirator. But they've never charged him with anything. So one of two things is going on with him. He either did it, and that would be a terrible thing, either, you know, was aware of all the malfeasance going on, or he wasn't. And if he wasn't, that would be a terrible thing too, because he's no longer in office because of all the innuendo and accusations that have been made. So either way that pans out, I'm sure we'll find out in the long run, it's been bad for our city. On top of that, we have two candidates for city council. As a matter of fact, one from Ward 6, his name was Kelvin Robinson. He was a newscaster in a previous life, and a guy from Ward 1, Jeff Smith, and they both pled guilty to taking illegal contributions, and this has all happened in the last month. Then, in addition to that, we have one councilman who's in jail. His name is also Michael Brown, and he's in jail for taking bribes from the FBI.
That's Michael A. Brown, isn't it?
Yeah, let's be very clear about that. Michael A. Brown, who's in jail for taking bribes from the FBI. Then we have another councilman, Harry Thomas, who was a Ward 5 councilman, who's just gotten out of jail for taking money that wasn't his, mostly from things like the Little League and sports programs for kids. He channeled it to a nonprofit and basically stole a bunch of money. Then we have Kwame Brown, who was chairman of our city council, who resigned because he lied on loan applications. But there's also a lot of other charges that have been labeled against him. For example, giving over $100,000 to his brother out of his campaign fund and never, ever reporting any of it. And, you know, that's just – it's just terrible. It's a mess. Imagine that. You have got three councilmen who – have had to resign or go to jail, and five of the mayor's top people and two council candidates all in the last few years. I mean, it's just a mess.
Yeah, here's a question from Pete, and he basically says, all politicians talk this talk. You have to have honest government and that you have to do the right thing. But what would you do to keep city council members honest if you were to be elected?
Well, that really is an excellent question, Pete, because we all talk the talk, you know, and I've heard other candidates say you don't have to do anything but elect good people. I don't believe that. I believe that you have to do something because, you know, as my dear old friend Niccolo Machiavelli would have told you, power corrupts. And ultimate power corrupts ultimately. So you need to have safeguards to make sure that politicians are walking the walk as well as talking the talk. And those safeguards have to be put into place, especially in the District of Columbia, because I believe in D.C. we have a culture of corruption. You know, not people. People don't go into political office, I think, with the idea of being corrupt. And I think that's a misconception that people have, that you know, people go, well, whoa, this is a way to, you know, get rich or have power. I don't think that's why people start. I think what happens is along the way, they lose sight of where they've come from and where they want to be. And the corruption is all around them, and it's very easy to partake in it. For example, I'll give you a clear example. Kwame Brown, who was the head of our city council, he came in and he ordered an SUV on his first day of work, a Lincoln Navigator. He's not allowed to have a car. Showed up with the wrong interior in it. So he ordered another one with a different color interior. That kind of malfeasance is just accepted in the District of Columbia. You know, we're like, well, he wants a car, get him a car, blah, 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 without thinking, this isn't his money. He doesn't get to spend it any way he wants. So I think there are a few things we need to do to end the culture of corruption. I think, first of all, being a council member in the District of Columbia should be a full-time job. A council member in the District of Columbia starts at $130,000 a year. That makes them the highest paid city council member in America, with the exception of Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, the population of Los Angeles is, I don't know how big it is these days, but it's 4 or 5 times the size of the District of Columbia.
I would think so, at least, possibly.
Yeah, so our people are among the highest paid to begin with. But then we had a councilman, a guy who's now running for mayor, who made $240,000 a year working for a city contractor while he was on the city council. I mean, how crazy is that?
Yeah, that's a conflict of interest, isn't it? I mean, it would seem to me.
How could it be more of a conflict of interest? You're paying me $240,000, and you say to me a year, and you say to me, I want to take you out to lunch and talk to you about a few things. And I go, oh, no. We can't do that. You know, that would be undue influence. Of course you're going to take that guy's phone calls. Of course you're going to listen to that person. Of course you're going to try to help him. I mean, who wouldn't? $240,000 a year he took. And we talk about things like limiting corporate contributions or getting rid of corporate contributions. Like, you giving me $1,000 is going to influence me, but you giving me $240,000 is not. It's just crazy. We need to change this. If you can't live on $130,000 in the District of Columbia, I understand that. I have a teenage daughter. My teenage daughter could spend $130,000 at the mall. If you can't make it on $130,000, I feel your pain. But go do something else for a living. Don't be a councilman. You know, go work for MC Dean, who are the guys that paid this man, David Catania, $240,000 a year. Or be a rocket scientist or a lawyer or whatever it is. I don't have any problem with people making money. But if you're working in the public interest, you need to serve the public interest. And in D.C., this is a $130,000 a year part-time job, and it shouldn't be. It should be a full-time job. So that's the first thing you could do to end the culture of corruption. The next thing you could do, which would be just as important, Pete, to get the job done, to walk the walk instead of just talk the talk, is you could stop this process where we review $1 million and plus contracts. The city council reviews those contracts. Now, on the first, in the first place, it makes no sense. Let's say right now we're debating an issue about the Virginia Avenue tunnel or the soccer stadium. That's even a better example. Mm-hmm. We're reviewing the building and construction of a soccer stadium in on the southwest waterfront. I am a really smart guy, and I've been in business for 25 years around the business, but I don't know anything about building a soccer stadium. Why the hell should I even decide where the contract goes? It just doesn't make any sense. We have people in the government who are professionals that work with contractors and building and land development and know these issues better than I would know them or any member on the council. And that's the first reason we shouldn't do it, because it's ridiculous. And secondly, it's malfeasance wrapped up in a bow. Come on. If you're reviewing contracts where people are going to stand to make millions of dollars on how they're awarded, you don't think that's corruption waiting to happen? It is, and we need to end that. Contracts should be reviewed by the people that were hired, the bureaucrats that have been hired to run the departments that the contracts apply to. They shouldn't be, councilmen shouldn't be allowed to do this. So that's the second thing you could do. And in this case, in the soccer stadium instance, we have the chairman of the city council's living girlfriend as one of the people that's deciding on who gets the contract. And he's saying that's not a conflict of interest because she's not getting paid. Oh my God, there's so much money, way to make money on that deal. She doesn't have to get paid. It's a conflict of interest. End it. Make sure that the people that are deciding on who gets the business and who gets the money aren't the same people that could benefit from that. That's what government's supposed to be about. So that's the second thing we could do, Pete. We could get rid of the contract review by the city council. And lastly, there was a law put in place and an organization created called BEGA, the Bureau of Ethics and Government Affairs. They have two employees who are responsible for keeping an eye on 30,000 District of Columbia employees, the entire city council, the mayor, and they have no statutory ability. They have no right to bring charges or prosecute people. Watchdog with no teeth doesn't provide you with very much protection. So we need to end that. We've met with these people. I've met with these people over BEGA, and they complain. They say there's no way we can do our job properly because we don't have the manpower. So we need to put more money into that. And also the Office of Campaign Finance. As I said earlier, we still have an outstanding case where Kwame Brown, the former head of our city council, gave $100,000 to his brother and never explained it. The Office of Campaign Finance doesn't have enough, and they're in charge of keeping politicians straight with the money they receive. And that's the third big thing we could do to change it. But we talk about these little things like corporate contributions, also constituent funds. Now, constituent funds have been used in the past to buy influence, people think. And that may be true, but I think we should have a constituent fund so that a councilman can buy tickets, give kids tickets to ball games, or help somebody with their rent if they need help to keep them from being evicted or there's an emergency. But let's make it all, if you want to get rid of the malfeasance or the corruption, let's make it all one big fund. One big fund that every councilman has equal access to, and then contributions could be given to people on behalf of the entire council and not an individual member, and that should take the corruption out of that. But those are the little things. The big things are make it a full-time job, stop reviewing contracts, and beef up the watchdogs whose job it is to keep an eye on these people who spend almost $10 billion of our money. I mean, you wouldn't let the people at the bank not have supervisors to make sure that they were taking your money and doing the right thing with it, or a brokerage firm, or you wouldn't have people in those positions without having somebody keeping an eye on them. But here in the city, we really don't do enough of it.
Well, Mary, it's kind of, I guess, along the same vein, but Mary Skyped in and said, are endorsements a bad or good thing for politicians?
Well, they're both. I mean, they're a good thing for politicians in that with endorsements sometimes come campaign contributions, which we have a shortage of in our campaign these days, and also manpower to go to the polls. But they also come with an obligation, I think. And it depends on who's giving you the endorsement. If you're endorsed by a labor union, that may not be a bad thing, but they expect you to represent them when you get there. A citizens group, they expect you to represent them when you get there. I would think that I don't know that there's any way we can stop people from endorsing or organizations from endorsing. But I'll tell you what, if you get to the city council the way I'm trying to do it, working and being endorsed only by the people, that is actually the best way to do it, because you're not beholden to anybody when you get there. You're not in a position where you have to pay anybody back. And I think that's the best way to get there, to say that the only people that I need to pay back, and I need to pay them back every day and every way I can, are the people that elected me, and those people are the general public. And you know, that's the problem with endorsements sometimes, is the people you have to pay back are very specific, and they shouldn't be. You should have to pay back everybody every day you're in that office. You should consider everybody's opinion and try to work to resolve problems for everybody in the city and not just for a handful of people that supported you. So that's the downside of endorsements. So I guess it depends, Mary, which side you're on. You know, they can be helpful as a candidate, but then as a citizen, I think you have to be skeptical of who gets what endorsements and what good they really are for us as a city.
I just want to thank everyone for writing in, and just repeat the phone number. It's 888-429-5471. And you can Skype your questions to BBS Radio too. And we are getting a lot of questions, so that's wonderful. You know, another thing I'd like to know is I don't understand why, you know, there's actually two seats that are coming up for the city council, correct?
Right.
You get to vote for two.
That's right.
And one of those people is the Democratic nominee.
Yeah.
And then you have all these other 14 people who are Democrats, except for maybe one or two, who's, I guess, the Green Party or whatever.
Libertarian, Republican.
Libertarian.
Yeah.
Okay. And the rest are independents who are really Democrats, but had to change their status to run. I mean, can you kind of explain why that's happening? Because I know there is some people who criticize that and some people who just say, well, that's the way it is. But maybe people who are listening don't quite understand why you're now an independent.
Well, you know, that's funny, because that was one of the first questions I was asked at a forum the other night at a place called the Black Cat. You were elected as a Democrat. Why are you no longer a Democrat? Well, we're forced to take on the independent moniker, I believe, because there was a set aside. Everything in Washington was negotiated when it was created. We're not. This is one of the reasons we need to be a state, and this is where corruption and statehood kind of overlap with each other. When we got the Home Rule Charter 40 years ago, limited home rule in the District of Columbia, we negotiated a deal, and the deal was that there had to be two set aside seats. And basically, they were set aside for Republicans, so that Republicans would always be part of the government. They said, okay, we'll set these two seats aside. And the way the legislation read is there must be two seats that do not on the city council that do not go to the majority party, and those seats are always at large seats because they represent the whole city. So basically, to run for this seat, we had to change our affiliation, and you're right, almost all of us are Democrats. We had to change our party affiliation to comply with the law. But it's a ridiculous law, a ridiculous rule to put on us, and it's very undemocratic. There's no other place in the country where this is done. In Arizona, you can have as many Republican elected officials as you want, which probably probably accounts for the fact that you have so many. And in Utah, there's only one Democrat elected to any office, a federal office in Utah. There are plenty of places which are solidly Republican, and nobody does this. Only in Washington, because they can do whatever they want here. They tell us, if you're not a member of the minority party, you cannot run for either one of these seats. And we've just found it to be ridiculous and draconian, and you know, I personally have fought for the past 8 years to get equality, and there's nothing equal about this. It's, you know, why a party affiliation? Why not something else? Why not a set aside for short people or fat people? I'm all for that. Fat people or middle-aged people or people, you know, old people or young people or people that were born here. You know, in New Zealand, you have to have a set aside. That's the only other place I've heard of a political set aside. And there is a set aside for native Maoris, the people that are the native population in New Zealand. Well, why not do that in Washington? If you're not born in Washington, you can't run in Washington because it doesn't make any sense.
Right, right. Well, let me ask you a question that I've been wondering. Do you feel that there have been enough forums or debate platforms for the city council at large race so that people can really figure out what the difference is between all of you?
I really don't think there has, you know, you know, the new kid on the block this time was the attorney general race. This is the first time we're ever going to elect an attorney general. Thing that's a reflection of how the city was set up and home rule was set up. Most states have elected attorney generals. But this is the first election for attorney general. So there were a lot of forums for electric for attorney general because it generated a lot of interest. But this is a very important position and there should have been more forums, I believe. Excuse me, it's been a long day, but there haven't been enough forums, and there should have been more.
Well, look, it looks like we are running out of time, and so I'm going to let you make some closing remarks, and then I will come back on to make a statement and a disclaimer. But I want to thank everyone who Skyped in with all these great questions. So don't forget, you do get to vote for two. And so consider carefully who your choices will be. And so, Mr. Brown, would you like to go with your closing statement?
Yeah, I would. I'd like to make a statement about honest government. You know, top D.C. government officials have pled guilty to serious charges and have had to resign, and many of them have been sentenced. Councilmen have gone to prison. Federal investigations continue, and a cloud hangs over the Wilson Building. It's time for reform. It's time for better enforcement. It's time for transparency and honest government. Although some campaign finance reform has been legislated and will take effect in 2015, more needs to be done, and we've talked about some of those things today. We can no longer accept a city council that reviews government contracts because this is a recipe for corruption, and most municipal government agencies should review and award independent approval by members of the city council. Doing business with the District of Columbia should be based on objective criteria applied by professionals. Time and time again, we read in the Washington Post and elsewhere about complaints of undue influence from members of the city council. It's time that we change a system rife with potential for abuse and replace it with a transparent system that protects the interests of D.C. taxpayers. It's time for the council to use a more professional approach in managing the district government. Better campaign finance reform is also needed. This must begin by strengthening the Office of Campaign Finance and BEGA. Both offices need more funding, more personnel, and more statutory power. Constituent funds should be restricted and carefully monitored to make sure they are used in the best interests of constituents. We should seriously consider one emergency fund, which all members, council members, have equal access to. Finally, being a member of the city council should be a full-time job. Allowing members of the council to have outside employment is asking for trouble. Besides, the potential conflict of interest is just tremendous. If you work for the people of the District of Columbia, they deserve your undivided attention. In addition to that, And finally, and most importantly, the District of Columbia should become the 51st state. We're so close to making progress on this issue that's been hanging out there for 213 years that we need to get a member of the city council that really cares about your interests and stands up for your rights. That's what I've been doing for the past 8 years. And if you elect me, I make you this promise that I will continue to stand up for your rights, that I will never, ever do anything to embarrass myself or my office, and that I will always represent the people that elected me, and that's you. I'll never represent special interests. I'll never represent anything that flies in the face of what the people of the District of Columbia deserve, and what they deserve is good government. So remember, on November 4th, you get to vote for two. Make one of those votes for change. Make one of those votes for democracy and statehood. Make one of those votes for Michael D. Brown, number one on the ballot, your first choice for a better D.C. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And always, it's just, you know, a great experience to hear you talk about the issues. I wish that there were more of these type of forums or internet town hall meetings that people could really get involved in. So I want to thank the audience for joining us. Please tune in next week on the same channel at the same time, 2 p.m., for our open forum. As mentioned previously, this town hall meeting will be archived on our campaign website, and I encourage you to share it with others who are interested in the upcoming election. You can also bbsradio.com, and they also archive all of the town hall meetings. Remember that you can submit questions to the campaign website for this meeting or the upcoming meeting next week, and we will do our best to answer as many as possible. And I encourage you to share it with others who are interested in the upcoming election. Again, that address is www.michaeldbrown2014.com. This is Kathleen Gomez saying thank you, and I hope you will tune in again next week. This program was paid for by Michael D. Brown for Council 2014, Patricia E. Brown, Treasurer, 4501 Western Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20016. A copy of our report is on file with the Director of the Office of Campaign Finance for the District of Columbia. This program was produced by BBS Radio, and all rights are reserved. Again, thank you so very much to the audience. Thank you, Mr. Brown. We look forward to talking to you and listening to you next Sunday. Goodbye.
Thank you.